It's crazy, 5 years later, to look back at COVID times as anything but the most surreal period in modern human history. The sheer size and scale of it, the whole planet, and for so long, 2 full years. Most people reflect on that time as a period of extreme isolation, public spaces closed and everything canceled, a generation scarred from a lack of human interaction. 2020 through 2022 is a period that nearly every citizen of Earth recounts with a similar, nearly universal set of feelings and memories. Memories of cardboard cutouts in the stands at sporting events, of staring at talking heads on a Zoom call for hours a day. Words like distance learning, social distancing, and mandatory quarantine. The smell of hand sanitizer and disinfectant spray. The feeling of sore ears and runny noses from wearing a mask 8 hours a day. In a word, the most common thought is probably loneliness. Travel? Almost nobody did that. For quite some time, the vast majority of airliners overhead flew with mostly empty seats and crates of PPE in the cargo holds. Masks, gloves, tubes of sanitizer. It wasn't even possible to get to some countries, and if you could, you wouldn't want to. The rules were inconsistent, and there were unexpected pitfalls and obstacles to seamless movement around every corner. They told us it wasn't safe to mix and mingle, and to shelter in place. For ferry pilots, though, we remember a different, surreal reality entirely. The effects of the travel bans and international policies meant that a huge swath of the world's airliner fleet became inactive. And an inactive airplane can't just sit parked on a ramp for months at a time, or it'll become worthless. Airplanes need proper storage and maintenance tasks to keep them airworthy, and we took on that mission with open arms. It was, hands down, the busiest period of time that we ever experienced. Mission after mission, we were forced to solve impossible puzzles in real time, getting airplanes where they needed to be amid a decimated airline route network and policies that prevented the free movement between many countries. On ferry flights, the hardest part is normally route planning for cost savings and efficiency, but during these times, by far the challenge was more just getting there or getting home. For the first time in over 20 years moving heavy metal, we relied on private air travel quite often. Sometimes it was the only way to get to a city. Case in point, Juba, South Sudan, where we had to charter a Falcon 10 air ambulance out of Paris just to repo a Dash 8 out of UN service. Or Alice Springs, Australia, where we chartered King Airs and Conquest from Brisbane and Darwin to cross state lines where restrictions in the country prohibited free movement. Other times it was to avoid quarantine. By flying private, we could orchestrate a wing-to-wing transfer, a procedure that involved the bizjet pulling up right next to our mission aircraft, allowing us to avoid customs entirely and just insert and extract from places like China, the UAE, Australia, and Cambodia. At one point, the average trip's travel cost was the biggest line item on a ferry flight invoice, requiring upwards of $100,000 just to simply position a crew. For our clients, it was becoming untenable, but there was simply no other way. Enter November 437 Sierra Juliet, an IAI Westwind 2 that we decided to purchase for less than $500,000. It had the capability, range, and budget to shuttle crews into position for a fraction of the cost of chartering a Lear or a Falcon. It was a strategic decision and a strategic win.
I love this thing.
Oh, me too, man. This is a cool-ass jet.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the low rider, but, I mean, look at this thing. This thing is so comfortable back here. It flies awesome, and it's got so much power.
And one we pivoted to a little too late in the game, if I'm honest. There aren't many Westwinds still flying. The parts are increasingly hard to find, and they're very expensive. There aren't any simulators left, and unless you're flying it yourself like we do, good luck finding a qualified crew. But all that aside, the Westwind cruises in the high flight levels at airliner speeds, it can stay airborne for over 6 hours, and it permits on-condition maintenance on a utilization basis instead of a calendar basis. Simply put, maintenance is primarily based on the hours that the airplane flies and not the calendar. I've said it before and I'll say it again. You buy the right airplane for your mission. In 2022, the Westwind was that airplane for us. Because there aren't simulators for the type anymore, the IA-1124A is considered a vintage type. Yeah, like a B-17 or a P-51, Connie or a DC-3. To acquire the type rating and to demonstrate proficiency, the FAA designates certain pilot examiners, DPEs, as vintage type examiners. And the training and checking, it happens in the jet itself. Bob and I did this down in Dallas, Texas, and in our own plane, with a Westwind expert named Jason. We did all the things you'd normally do in a simulator, like stalls and steep turns, unusual attitudes, a ton of landings, even touch and goes. Instrument approaches, and yes, even V1 cuts, pulling one engine back to idle on the takeoff roll after V1, and continuing airborne on one engine. It's perhaps one of the most important maneuvers that we even do in training and checking.
We're at Redbird Airport now in Dallas. We're taking fuel where it's a little cheaper, and then we're gonna head over to Roswell, which is actually only about an hour and 20 minutes away. And we're gonna get our first taste of doing this ourselves.
Honestly, the Westwind is like a mini DC-9 in my opinion, and Bob and I have a lot of time on the DC-9. No moving maps or glass screens or modern conveniences. This thing is old school. The RNAV system, a universal UNS-1. It's the same box I cut my teeth on in the Dash 8 decades ago. The vintage bird isn't for everybody, and nowadays, few still maintain the chops to operate it safely and comfortably. But on paper, Bob and I are excellent examples of niche operators. It just worked. But that doesn't mean that there's no downside. The sight picture landing a jet at 120 knots, 6 inches off the pavement, is not normal for a couple of guys that typically flare an A330, a 75, and 320s and 73s. To consistently grease a landing on the Westwind, you need to fly it pretty regularly. The same goes for the flurry of button presses on the UNS-1, and for operating the early rudimentary autopilot. After COVID, our mission dried up, and the airplane really just became more of a novelty, a hangar queen that flew a few times a year. The cost of owning it quickly outweighed any benefit we received from the airplane. Bob and I are experienced pilots, each with well over 20 to 25,000 hours in many different jets, but the result of that experience is a true sense of what feels good and what doesn't. Because of this experience, we know our limitations, and with the infrequency of operating this thing, we both felt less than safe getting behind the wheel with our coworkers, friends, and family aboard. After dragging feet for probably way too long, we listed it for sale last month. You'll probably remember that I did a cockpit casual on this plane a while back, so some of the footage here probably looks familiar to you. But I wanted to do one last piece on the jet, just because it marked an interesting chapter in Nomadic's story. We're turning the page now, and what's next for us as an airplane? I don't know yet. We're still working on it. Stay tuned. All right, I'm Steve Giordano.
I'm Bob Allen.
And this is Cockpit Casual, the podcast.
And we didn't step on each other that time when we said it.
I purposely shut the F up after I said it, just to see if you would say episode 8. Or is it 8?
Yeah, it is 8.
Yeah, all right.
And
well,
as you can see, I don't have an amp or the normal stuff behind me.
Yeah, where are you?
I'm in Lexington, Kentucky. So I'm out here for the week hanging out, so... Got a little bit different environment, so I set up my laptop, and this is the background.
So get used to it, because this is what it's going to look like in the summer with Bob, and I'm going to be in a different location, too, because we head to the beach for the summer at some point. We have a house on the Jersey Shore, and it'll be laptop, although I'm planning to bring my mics. I can't sacrifice audio quality.
Yeah, so getting back to the video that you just ran... Wow, man, that brings back some, I don't know if I could say good memories with the COVID part of it.
It was a mixed blessing, right?
God, it really was. I mean, man, that was, God, it seems like a lifetime ago that happened.
I know. It wasn't that long ago, really. I mean, it went on for so long. When I was making this thing, I realized about halfway through that I was making a COVID documentary 5 years too late.
Right.
I filmed a few trips during COVID that never made it to video. One of them was that one where the escape from Korea. That might be a good story to tell on the pod sometime. Maybe I'll do that later.
Yeah, you can probably tell it now.
I think we've passed the statute of limitations.
Right. There was some escape. An escape from Korea.
That was going to be the name of the episode, but I decided probably it wasn't a good idea to put it out because I literally fled the country with a second passport.
Yeah. Well, that's a story in itself. And that's one for the future for sure.
Yeah. You know, the last time we started with the video, and it's a weird thing making a video for a podcast that's also audio, because, I mean, I have to talk the whole time, you know?
Yeah.
But I kind of throw it together. It doesn't have the same quality as regular Cockpit Casual, but, you know, I aim for that feel to hold people over. But anyway, I wanted to do a little tribute to the West Wind. Tomorrow is the day that we hopefully never see it again. It's...
Well, you say that like we hate the thing.
I don't. I'm gonna miss sitting in it while in the hangar while my son goes on his flying lessons in the Cherokee. But
yeah, well, that was the problem, right? It we sat in it more than we flew it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's time. So it's heading down to Florida for a pre-buy borescope, and if all goes well, it will change hands and it will head to South America to a new owner who has a mission that this will perfectly support. So, you know, I wish them luck. At least I will wish them luck after we close.
Yeah, after they accept the airplane and pay for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be great to see that airplane flying. It is such a good airplane.
It is.
It really needs to fly, and I hope somebody can get some use out of it.
Yeah, it's one of the last ones, too. It's one of the last ones built.
Yeah, what was it, fourth the last?
437.
Or, yeah.
I think they made 440 something, maybe 450. I don't know. So it was definitely, you know, it was definitely one of the last ones. It was a great airplane. It is a great airplane. I wish it was single pilot, and I wish it was cheaper to maintain.
Burn less gas.
Yeah, I mean, just all of the above, man. It's just it's not a plane you could just get in and go. You know,
exactly. Yeah, it was. It's so much easier to have an airplane you can just fly with just a single pilot.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm sitting here rocking one of the worst Phillies baseball teams I've seen in years, man. God, they're terrible. Not to change the topic too drastically, they're so bad. Your Diamondbacks just completely. Well, that was the last series. We lost that series. They totally shat on us. And the Cubs, who stink, shat on us. And I don't even want to talk about it. I'm so bummed about baseball right now.
I know so little about baseball that you're not going to be able to talk about it much anyway. You'd have to get my son on here. He would talk for hours about the particulars.
I know, man. Baseball and football, but really baseball is kind of my thing. But anyway I just noticed my hat while I was talking, and I realized I'm rocking such a lousy team. But, yeah, you know, it's early.
It's your hometown team, whatever.
So what else? We don't have any guests today. We have some stuff to talk about. You know, it's Thursday night again, and, I listened to some news.
It's the same news as last week and the week before, it seems like. Just goes on and on.
Yeah, no, I'm referring to all the talk of mergers in the industry.
Yeah, there's some good ones out there.
There's some good ones. Well, I mean, so for one, not talking merger, Spirit is on death's door again. One of our clients called me today, and we're back on standby to grab some Spirit airplanes if the liquidation happens. I mean, I hear that like once a month, though.
Yeah, yeah, we've heard that for like a year,
yeah,
maybe longer. I don't know, but there are a lot of rumors going around, and just noticed on different forums and, you know, on X, a lot of pilots talking about they've heard heard rumors of a potential liquidation over there, or a complete shutdown, whatever you want to call it. But
well, I mean, they were hurting beforehand. I don't know how they're doing it with the price of fuel right now. I mean, thank God they're not in Europe, where like jet fuel is unable to be found in some locations. I mean, it's crazy over there.
Well, you wonder what you wonder how worse it's going to get with, you know, with, you know, those ships not moving with the oil to the refineries and the refineries. I mean, even if it started flowing again right now, how long, what's the lag in that time? You know, are we talking about another month, two months?
No, it's going to be more than that, because there's oil infrastructure that's been destroyed over there is what we're hearing. I I've heard a lot of different things. At this point, I don't know what necessarily to believe, because media in general now is just, I mean, you just don't know what's real and what's not.
Yeah.
You know, but what I'm hearing is that could take a year or two to come back to normal, and I think that we're going to need to brace for the long haul on the economic stuff. I mean, there's just, I don't know. Don't even get me started.
I know. Well, obviously the oil prices affect so many different industries in so many different ways.
Everything.
And the the whole world economy. It's I guess we're just going to have to see. But yeah, you're right. I don't know how the airlines are going to survive oil prices, you know, at the levels that they are. I mean,
and Spirit was hurting before. Like they must be bleeding out now.
Every airline that I've been with that's shut down has been due to oil prices going high. Situations like this where oil spikes up and the airline just can't afford to pay its bills anymore. And they shut down, clear bankruptcy, and that's it.
Yeah. Right now, I'm seeing across our system, because I quoted a bunch of trips this week, I'm seeing, I would guess, an average fuel price across our entire network of about $6 right now. And then we were sub-3 2 months ago.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to another client today that has some other business where they charter some airplanes, and those contracts have increased 30%, just 30% on their fuel. You know, where they had built in the fuel price adjustments.
And like biz jets or
not large aircraft.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah, 30, it's 30%.
And the thing is nobody wants to make major changes. Well, quite frankly, you know, we just talked about COVID, and a lot of mistakes were actually made by the airlines by reacting too fast to that situation. If you look at American Airlines, and we'll talk about them again a little bit in a minute, because I want to talk about some of these merger rumors, but you look at American Airlines, and right away, the first thing they did in COVID was that, you know, they sensed that it was going to be a long, drawn out pain session, you know, maybe lasting months, years, whatever. And so they took it upon themselves to modernize their fleet. And by modernize, I mean just get rid of the old stuff. So they parked all their 75s and 76s and A330s, like right in the beginning of COVID. And as it turns out, they shot themselves in the foot. They needed that long haul lift. I mean, they didn't need it immediately. I mean, they could have parked it and then brought it all back online, but they decommissioned everything. And they've been struggling ever since. The 787s haven't come in fast enough. I don't think they're taking triples anymore.
I don't think so. You know, when you compare that to, Delta still operating those 757s that they've had forever. The 76s.
United too.
And United.
Yeah. So,
yeah. And they seem to be healthy, at least up until now. Maybe they are weathering this. Okay. I don't know.
Well, maybe United and American will merge like they were saying this week, and then American will get 75s again.
Okay, so let's talk about that potential merger. I mean,
there's no way.
Do you think that's for real? Is Kirby just trolling American?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what do you think? You're taking an airline CEO and putting him in charge of government policy. I mean, the policy is just going to make airline CEOs richer, right?
I mean, yeah. I mean, if that goes through, if you were the Spirit CEO, wouldn't you just be pissed? I mean, they wouldn't let JetBlue buy them.
Yeah. Well, let me say this. So I listened to the air show today. I don't know if you listened to the air show pod. They are like they're like av nerds. Like they're like the smart av geeks. We're like the stupid av geeks. You know, you come to us for the feels. You come to them for like the knowledge, right?
Yeah.
I highly recommend it. I learn a lot when I listen to it. Sometimes I don't learn much because they're even speaking in languages that I don't quite understand. They're three smart fellas, and it's a great pod. But they were talking about the mergers today, and they were going deep in it, talking about what the government's been saying, what Kirby's been saying, past precedents, and the implications of such. Again, like I said, you come to us for the feels, and you're gonna get the emotional reaction from a couple of outsiders that just look in, right? Pilots. Pilots are never the authority on this stuff. We just think in our own interests, of course.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. I just, I know as much of this stuff that everybody else is, watching on X and the news and whatever else.
Yeah.
I have no insider knowledge whatsoever about the airline industry. Well, I mean, it just doesn't.
Yeah.
Just not into it.
For sure. Well, because the nuts and bolts of the airline industry isn't about planes and destinations. It's about share value and, that boring
stuff.
Credit cards. Right. Right. That whole nightmare.
Yeah.
Another more drama. We don't even get into that yet. But in my opinion, based on the observations I've made throughout my career in aviation, mergers generally don't take two things and create something greater. They take two things. One is usually doing better than the other, and then everything stinks like the thing that like the entity that came to it that stunk, right?
Yeah.
And I made a post to that degree, to that effect, about the potential United American merger, where someone was like, "Oh, I live in Philly. This will be, and I fly United. This will be great for me." And I said, "Yeah, be careful what you wish for, essentially, because you don't want Americans stink all over United." And that's the fact. I mean, trust me, I was the American Airlines loyalist all over social media,
just raving
about American and One World. I was concierge key for 9 years. American was once a great product, and it got so bad that unless there's some reason I have to fly American Airlines, I stick to United on as far as U.S. carriers go.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty loyal to United now, whereas I was loyal to American for several years and then Delta before that.
Yeah.
Everybody loves Delta, but in my personal experience, Delta went, way downhill.
Absolutely.
I was Diamond for 12 years to 2 million miler, almost 3 million miler at Delta.
Was the Northwest merger the conduit for the downfall of – I don't know. I'm asking that. I'm just wondering about the timing.
It was more like I stopped flying them, when we started flying at American, when we had the corporate deal there.
Yeah.
That's when I stopped flying Delta, but that's around the – the late teens, like 2018, 2019 –
yeah,
it's kind of okay. Time frame. I don't know. The customer service just went way downhill.
And for me, Delta, the problem with Delta for me is Atlanta is the issue. Like if I lived on the West Coast and I could fly out of Seattle or Salt Lake or something, or even Detroit maybe, but Atlanta is the worst place to connect. That airport is. I hate that airport.
Yeah, I mean I'm in Phoenix most of the time, so American obviously is huge there. But United's got a pretty big presence as well. And I can go to San Francisco, Denver, Houston, or Chicago. So I can get just about anywhere on United. Works out pretty well.
And I'm an hour from Newark, which is, you know, I'm 20 minutes from Philly, but I'm an hour from Newark, and that involves the turnpike, but it's well worth it. There's more parking. I mean, I'm in Philly. I circle the lots looking for spots. Yeah. Philly is tiny. The airport's small. I talk about Atlanta being bad. Philly's worse. You know, it's arguably significantly worse.
Yeah.
I would say Philly, Charlotte, Atlanta, worst three airports in the country.
Yeah, I definitely avoid Charlotte. If you're trying to connect through there on American, forget it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Atlanta's not even small. Like Charlotte and Philly are old airports that just got bigger by adding Legos onto the Lego set. You know what I mean? It's they didn't build new terminals. They just put new gates in. I don't even know what they did, but
yeah,
everything's tight. That's how Philly is. Philly and Charlotte are both a nightmare like that. Atlanta's big. And at one time it was big and nice, but it's just overcrowded and dirty and passengers standing in the – I mean, you're just pushing through people all the time there. The lounges are full. Yeah. Anyway, I digress.
Well, you just wonder, the merger thing always seems to take 10 years to sort out, and it's just problems for 10 years. I mean, then you look at the pilot merger part of it, and then you all end up suing each other and they hate each other, and it's just a disaster half the time, you know, and then 10 years later, you know, I don't know, half the people are retired and I guess life goes on. They figure it out. But,
well, I mean, the bottom line is I would just say as an outside observer that bigger isn't always necessarily better. And, you know, I don't want to talk trash about our client LATAM, but and they've got a lot going for them. And South America is a way, way different market, but they are so big that it's just, that's their biggest problem is their size. Because they're so big, because there's so many AOCs, because it's so complex, because there's so many processes and redundancies with people, nothing gets done.
It's just hard to manage. I mean, it's hard to manage a behemoth like that.
Right. And then think about the overlap with American and United. You got both strong presence in New York, both a strong presence in LA, although American less and less. You got Houston and Dallas.
Yeah.
You know, you got DC and DC.
Exactly. You look at this from the airfare point of view. You know, how competitive, you know, is it going to affect competition? Honestly, I don't know. From my point of view, I've been involved in startups and I know the big boys. They all say they don't collude. And maybe I shouldn't be saying those kind of words here, but they definitely talk.
No collusion.
There's no collusion, but they definitely talk and they definitely squeeze out the weak, the new entrants and the weak. They kill them off. And, you know, I don't know. I think they have cocktail parties together or something. They all talk about it. It's not collusion.
It's not collusion. No collusion.
No collusion.
But listen, here's the God's honest truth. The PAXX, like the cabin, like between American, United, Delta on the long haul. I won't even talk about domestic. I mean, really, let's include both domestic and international. They're all really generally the same. Okay, there's not one that's significantly better than the others. All their food is kind of middle to bad. Lounges can be different.
Yeah.
The seats are generally the same. United has got mostly Polaris out there now in their fleet, even on the older airplanes. Americans all – I mean, I saw some new products that they're coming out with for the A321XLR. I haven't seen it in real life yet, and I hope not to, if we're being honest. But it's all the same. Where they differ is in culture, and that's that's one of the things that makes these mergers so complicated, because you're not just talking culture within the pilot groups, but you're talking about culture within management and within like maintenance and in operations, and you're mixing two very different cultures. The end result is not going to instantaneously be better. Maybe over time it will smooth out to something better. But generally speaking, like I said before, it's the hairy, stinky one that ends up pulling the rest of it down. And I just – I haven't really seen a great result with regard to merger.
I don't know.
You sign up to be a pilot for the airlines, you sign up for the roller coaster. There's just no other way around it. It's going to be a ride, and the wheel will just keep turning and turning, and there's never going to be a time where you're like, all right, that's behind us. It's smooth sailing from here, because it's never smooth sailing from here. There's always something.
It's a cyclical industry. I mean, it always has been. It always will be. I mean, as long as the price of oil fluctuates, there's always going to be these huge fluctuations in airlines and what happens with them, and same thing with, other economic conditions that affect people flying or not.
We were talking earlier and you mentioned that you got some emails from guys that were complaining about us.
I wouldn't call it complaining. I would say maybe venting or maybe looking for some direction. So this all came about from our last podcast, which was, we were talking about mental health, and I did get a lot of good feedback from that podcast. People saying, thank you for talking about this. People kind of telling me their story and how they overcame this or that. And, I appreciate people sharing those things with me. And I'm glad that podcast helped you if it did. We're definitely going to have Dr. Powell back again to continue the conversation. But is what kind of came out of left field were some direct messages and things to me talking about the podcast, but talking about it in a way that, like, you don't understand how I feel. And it was in terms of career progression, and these were mostly younger people that have recently got their CFI or have been out there instructing for the last couple of years, mm-hmm. saying, you and Steve don't understand how it is out there. You guys have this great career, and everything goes great for you. And I'm like, What are we portraying here? I mean, like, look, I'm almost 60 years old. I've been doing this for 44 years. I mean, the first 20 were a disaster. It wasn't until I was 35, plus that what was Avia Crew Leasing that turned into Nomadic actually became something and became successful and kind of, so, I don't know if stabilized my life is the right word.
You certainly changed it in one way or another.
Yeah. But I wasn't on that, career roller coaster. Look, when I was young, when I was in my 20s, I was fighting for everything that I could get. I mean, I had 10 different jobs. I worked for 10 different airlines, by the time I was 35 years old. I mean, that was, started into the airline business when I was 21. And I mean, that's a lot of jobs.
You were flying the Wright Flyer, I believe.
Yes. Me and Orville. Okay, I don't go that far back.
No, you've seen a lot more than me. I mean, you started flying in the 80s.
Yeah, early 80s. There were no jobs back then. An airline career was out of the question.
It was all military.
You couldn't even consider it. I mean, it was just like, become a pilot and go find something to fly. Maybe a corporate job or I don't know. I mean, it was really a career that was... You kind of had no real future, no stable future if you were going to get into aviation.
Interestingly, let me prompt you a little bit here, because I you have an interesting story. Talk about hardship. Why don't you talk about your first class at your first airline?
Gosh, that would have been Jetstream International.
Yeah. You know where I'm going with this.
Yeah. So we started class, And this is my this is my first airline. Yeah, Jetstream. And the airplanes that we were getting trained on were Jetstream 3100s, the 19-seat turboprops. We start class. The class prior to us is finishing their check rides. Well, they were doing check rides at night, doing it in the actual airplane. There were no Jetstream simulators back then. And
you're in Indoc at this point.
Yeah. That airplane ends up doing a single engine go around and they got too slow. Airplane rolls upside down. They crash. Kills the class.
The entire new hire class of pilots, all sitting on the airplane in the back, taking their turn, going up front for their check ride.
And it was a very somber time, of course.
Yeah.
And then we were next. And, you know, obviously the training got very, very serious at that point in all respects. And it was, it was a hard time. You know, being there for all of that. And, you know, we still went out there and did the same thing, did single engine go arounds and V1 cuts in the real airplane. I mean, there was no choice.
You had to do it. I mean, people are already, I'm sure, in the comments saying, you guys are unsafe because you did V1 cuts in the West Wind, which on that video I just
get that
played.
All the time. I see those in the comments constantly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, my comments always back are, what what do you suggest we do? If there's no simulator, what do you do to train? I mean, this is how it used to happen in the old days. I mean, when I got type rated on the 737 and the DC-9, I did it in a real airplane. We did V1 cuts in DC-9s and 737s. Just the way it was. There was not simulators that were certified for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the simulator, I don't know when this, and the simulators, I don't know the history of them. I know that when they first started, the visuals were an actual camera that moved along. They have that at the American Airlines Training Center down there in Dallas. They have the old, like a big board of like farmland and like
fake
houses,
buildings
and streets.
And stuff. Yeah.
And like that was your visuals.
Yeah. So I wasn't flying that far back.
You weren't flying for an airline that had that kind of technology either. So
no, definitely not. Yeah, that was high tech.
So your first gig was like, holy moly, like, you know, imagine being in ground school and the class before you perishes in a crash. That's just the beginning. And you've had many, many, I mean.
Yeah. And that was, you know, gosh. There was a whole time of, you know, flying single engine airplanes. I mean, I started when I was 16 years old. So, you know, 17, get your private. 18, I had a commercial license. And at 18, I was out hustling every day. I literally lived at the airport. And, I mean, I was flying every day, flying something and somebody to fly somewhere in a single or a twin. And, I hustled. And I was willing to go anywhere. I mean, I used to send out resumes. This is when you actually had to type them. No, there was not even faxes.
You'd send them. So I was in the fax resume generator. I would like blast fax my resumes out.
Yeah.
You had to put a stamp on them.
Yeah. You had to go buy a list of, you know, addresses or find them. So, you know, I mean, you couldn't get on the internet and find an address for an airline. So there was these guys that would make lists and sell them. And I think it was like in the back of Flying Magazine or something. They would always be able to trade a plane. Trade a plane was always the place, man. You could find anything on Trade a Plane.
Yeah.
So there were job newsletters and there were address newsletters with the chief pilot's name. So, you know, you knew who to put attention to on the envelope. And then you would mail it. And I would mail out hundreds of these things. I mean, I would send them to airlines, charter. I mean, you name it. Every address I could find, I would send a resume to, and this like cheesy cover letter. And of course, I mean, yeah, I never heard from from any of them. And, you know, but that, you know, is what that did force me to do was network, man. I mean, I used to literally drive around to airports and just go knock on doors.
Yeah.
I would go to hangars. I would find anybody with an open hangar. I would knock on doors and just introduce myself and say, you know, I want to go flying. I mean, it wasn't even about money. I didn't care about the money part of it. And, you know, I mean, that's what, with all these younger people that are complaining about, you know, their airline dreams at, you know, 1200 hours or 1500 hours or whatever, not happening. It's like, it's a blessing in disguise, honestly. It's like, go out there and have fun. Go get some fun aviation jobs. It's an adventure. That's what you should be in this for.
Start writing your story. You know, it's funny. You say it's a blessing in disguise. I had a blessing in disguise at 1200 hours. So I was a flight instructor. You didn't flight instruct, right?
No.
So I that's how I built all my time early on, was flight instructing. And I flight instructed in Arizona, and I also flight instructed back east. I was a flight instructor for years. I have over 2300 hours of dual given. And I was a CFII, MEI. I worked at 141 schools. I worked at 61 schools. At one point I thought I was going to be a professional flight instructor for the rest of my life because of how horrendous the job market was. Then 9/11, and it got even worse. But when I had 1,200 hours, I was doing the same thing. First of all, back then there was no ATP requirement for Part 121 airlines, but there were nobody getting jobs there either at the regionals. Like, they started getting competitive for the regionals around 1,500 to 2,000 hours. We're talking like late 90s, and because 97 is when I started flying, and. So 500 hours was Part 135 minimums, and for right seat or for single pilot in like a Piper Lance. So I wanted to go fly for like Ameriflight or one of these Czech, one of the Czech hauling.
Yeah, they used to have Czech hauling companies.
Czech hauling, right? Like the younger people aren't even going to know what that means.
Right.
When you write a check, like when you write a –
I don't know if people know what those are.
They don't? I still write checks. Look, I got checks. I got a checkbook in my desk. I do occasionally. When you write a check at a store, they would stick it under the register, and there was no electronic anything. And they would – every night they would send it, bring it to the bank, and then the banks would like pass it to these check clearinghouses that would – literally, their job was they would take all the checks and they would, I don't know, somebody calls the bank and verifies the funds, and then they deduct the funds and then they send it to the check clearinghouse. But the physical paper checks had to be flown like a couple hundred miles.
To wherever, right? The clearinghouse was.
Wherever the clearinghouse was, you know, say maybe it's in Altoona, PA, and like you have Piper Lances and Navajos and Cherokees. I mean, any and every type of. In fact, the Aerostar was like
the big one.
It was the check hauler of choice, the 600, because it was fast. It you know, you take out the seats in the back, and they don't weigh a ton. I mean, they're not that heavy, so you just put in these giant plastic cases or boxes of checks, and you fly them to the clearinghouse. Somebody picks it up. So anyway,
it was a whole industry. People, it was a massive industry.
Massive, massive. It just went away overnight.
It literally, like the internet came along, and poof, it was gone.
Who was the company that was it? Ameriflight that was StarCheck? I think it is, right?
I think so.
I think it's still their call sign.
I think so. Yeah, that's how StarCheck. They got. That's what they started doing.
And that's why they were flying checks.
Yeah.
And I remember, man, I was like, oh, dude, as soon as I get 500 hours, I'm going to go get a job flying a Lance, flying checks.
Fly the checks.
And this was like in the end days of check flying. That must have stopped like in the late 90s. There was still a little bit of it happening.
Yeah.
Probably early 2000s, it just completely went away.
Yeah.
But but anyway, so I'm blast mailing my resume. I can't even get a call to haul checks in a piston at single, right? There was nothing. Well, out of the blue one day, I get this call from a company up in Bennington, Vermont called AirNow. I don't know if they're still around or not. They were starting to get Caravans, but they were running Embraer 110 Bondurantes, single pilot in Vermont, in the mountains, in the snow, the worst possible weather. And they called me up for an interview. So I'm like, wow, like this is a turbine job. And I'm like, okay, maybe I'll be a co-pilot or something like that up there. So I, you know, bought a cheap suit, got in my car, and I drove to Bennington, Vermont from the Philadelphia area. It took a very long time. And I go up there and I stay at this hotel and I'm like nervous. And I show up the next day and I go for my interview and they do a sim eval. It was on like a Frasca, like 810 or something, you know, it was like one of those old fashioned, no visuals, just like a, remember those simulators? Like they sit on like a desk.
Yeah.
And they're like, they have like a six pack of instruments. And then there was like, it looked like a polygraph in the back. Like, you know, you could see it would like draw, like the real sophisticated ones would like draw your flight path on paper.
Yeah.
So it was one of those things. And like, you know, we go up and I'm like, you know, I enter a hold and then I shoot an ILS and then I do a go around and I shoot a VOR approach and an NDB approach. And it went really well. And then, I mean, I had been teaching, I was a double I at the time. I had a lot of instrument experience, very recent, like six-pack instrument experience. And I get finished with the semi-eval, and I go down and sit with the chief pilot. And he says, before he even says a word, he looks at my resume and he looks at me. He goes, your sim looked great, honestly. He goes, I'm really impressed for a guy with 1,200 hours. You have really good instrument skills. He goes, but I'm going to stop you right there. He goes, we're hiring for single pilot in the Embraer Bondurante, in the one Embraer 110. He goes, let's go out into the hangar and take a look at it. I'm like, all right. I'm like all excited and everything. So we go out in the hangar, we walk into the airplane, and it's like, I mean, it's big to me.
Yeah. Right?
I've been flying Grumman AA1Cs. And, you know, it's round dials and old and like and everything. And I'm like, oh, this is gonna be a challenge. But he goes, look, does this scare you? I'm like, no, I'll be all right. He goes, son, he's like, you're going to kill yourself in the first week. Listen, he goes, I appreciate your ambition, but come back when you have 2,500 hours. I said, all right. Drove all the way back to South Jersey and started flight instructing again. So anyway, the guy probably saved my life because I would have accepted the job.
Yeah, you would have died in a bandit.
Right into the side of a mountain, most likely.
God, man. I didn't even know those things were single pilot.
Well, I mean, they must have made them single pilot for the purposes of flying checks or whatever they were flying up there, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I didn't get that job, and then it was a while. I ended up getting a Caravan job a year or two later. And then 9/11 happened, and I was at Cape Air, and you know, I was at Shuttle America on the Saab 340, and I quit that, and then I went to Mesa and flew the Dash and then Allegiant. Look, I have not had a storied career. you take like the crappiest airlines that have ever existed, and odds are like I've flown for them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, that's what everybody's asking me. Well, you know, what are low time jobs and all of that? And I go back to my first job was flying skydivers. And which was a story in itself. So there used to be this guy out at Lexington Bluegrass that I met. And I was working line out there, and I was just an airport bum kid that was out there all the time. I mean, 24/7, I was out there talking to people. And there was a guy that would come and go, and he's like, "Hey, you know, you got your private pilot's license yet?" I said, "Yeah, well, I said, I'm getting it in a few weeks. Or let me know when you get it." I said, "Hey." Saw him out there, drove a white Jaguar XJS. See him. "Hey, got my license." He goes, "Okay, I want to introduce you to somebody." So takes me down to this grass field south of Lexington. And it's Skydiving Club. Kind of trying to think what it was, Thunderbird Sport Parachute Club. And they had these old like 1950 something 182s. The ones that used to have those straight tails. And these things, I'm not sure. You know, I think they had an annual maybe 30 years ago or something.
They were skydiving out of 152s?
No, 182s.
Oh, 182s.
Yeah,
okay.
1950.
Sorry, it's late.
Yeah, 1950s era.
Okay.
182s.
All right.
Which were great airplanes, honestly.
With the door removed? Or?
Yeah. Well, it had a door modified to where the door would come out and kind of attach to the wing. And had a little latch on the bottom. You'd slip the airplane, it would slam the door shut when you were after the jumpers jumped out.
Yeah.
But anyway, this guy introduces me to the owner of the jump club. And he's a regular down there. And he's like, come down here and I'll teach you some real flying. And so I did. So the first thing they did was say, hey, have you ever flown on, you know, in and out of a grass strip before? Nope, never have. All right, we'll jump in. We're going to go for a ride. Now, there's only one pilot seat in these airplanes. And I'm in it. And I'm thinking, what happens if I do this wrong? And of course, I didn't say that. Jump in it, go trucking down this grass strip, rotate, take off, come back. And they're like, all right, come in, you know, hold 70 knots. There's some power lines here, you know, watch out for those trees, blah, blah, blah.
So are these guys sitting on the floor?
Yeah.
On the floor?
They're on the floor. Talking me through this stuff. Come down, I land. Well, not too long after that, I'm down there every weekend flying these jumpers. And then through the week, they're like, hey, can you come down? We're going to do this. We're going to do that. So they started having me fly at night. And so I'm going in and out of this grass strip at night. And this guy is teaching me how to land with no light.
Jesus.
Yeah. And I'm
so
like,
so how did you do it?
I
got to know.
Well, initially, you put a car at the end of each end of the grass strip.
No.
Yeah.
A car?
Cars with the lights on, so it lights up the runway. Then you take away one of the cars, and you only light up one end. And then you do it with the airplane lights off. No landing light, no nothing. Come in, land. Try to land on top of the car that's at the end of the runway. You try to just land right on top of it, and you're not going to land on it. You land right past it. Just set up a rate of descent till you touch down.
So you got to touch down in the light print. Like,
yeah.
The extent that the headlights extend onto the grass is all you could actually see.
That's it. And so,
damn.
So we do this for a while until you have, you know, kind of a not a completely dark night, but a night with, you know, a moon and you know, a little bit of light out there, and then no cars. Because we knew the airfield. I knew the airfield, you know, well enough at that point where I could come down. I could land that thing at night.
Hold on a second.
Take off.
Were they
and
just
land.
Fucking with you, Bob? Because who skydives at night?
Well, there was some other missions that they were practicing.
Oh, I see where we're going here.
And well, turns out that the guy I knew at the airport with that white Jaguar XJS was the guy that you saw at the beginning of the Cocaine Bear. The guy
that jumped
out with all that cocaine strapped to him. That was the guy that got me my first job and
wow.
And taught me how to fly those old 182s at night with no lights.
That explains some things, Bob.
So my career started out very exciting. And from there, I decided I was going to live a very exciting life. It's honestly, you know, looking back, I was probably being groomed for, you know, some shady business.
Until they died.
And then, like, literally. Like when I was, I guess I was like 18 or 19, he ends up getting killed, just like you saw in Cocaine Bear, jumped out of an airplane, cocaine strapped, and ends up dying in a, you know, in Knoxville, Tennessee, in a driveway in Knoxville, Tennessee. A partner of his ends up dying a week later in a parachuting crash, a caravan parachuting crash, in a caravan that I was supposed to get checked out in. And they were going to start like a 135 cargo company and all kinds of stuff that I was, you know, that's what I was going to go do. And literally all of these people like got killed or disappeared in that whole, scenario. And I went on to, you know, doing some corporate flying and charter and into the airlines eventually.
Yeah. And then out.
And then out. And then back to the wild life of fairy flying.
I 9/11 was the big obstacle for me. I did the single pilot freight thing in the caravan. The Cape Air was like, that's one of those experiences that I would never trade. I made some great friends, guys that I'm still in touch with now that are all flying for different airlines. Some of them are retiring. I mean, this was a long time ago. But you know, that was like it was single pilot Cessna 402s passengers. It was a safety conscious operation, but operating in a dangerous environment. I mean, operating complicated piston twin aircraft loaded to the gills, you know, in terrible weather in the Northeast, in ice and snow and all that stuff. And again, it's the same thing that I tell anybody who's looking for advice in this industry. I sound like a broken record, and I'm sure people that have listened to me speak on podcasts and different things in the past, they all hear me say the same thing. And that is, don't map out your career and expect to follow that trajectory, because it's not going to happen. And quite frankly, you'll be lucky if it doesn't happen, because the things that you do along the way are going to be the things that kind of define you, not just as a pilot, but as a person. It's you know, get kicked in the nuts early and often, and you won't feel it by the time you get kicked in the nuts for like the 15th time. I mean, exactly. That's just the nature of this. Sadly, and look, my boys are going into this field. Yeah, two of my youngest two boys.
Exactly. My son's in it. I mean, my son's, 30 years old now. He's been doing it for 10 plus years. I mean, he's been, you know, in and out of the jobs and kind of climbing the ladder as well. Yeah, your boys are going to be, you know, well into it soon.
Yeah, Ryan's going to do he was supposed to do his first solo cross country on Saturday, but the weather's going to be bad. So it's going to end up happening probably early next week. But he just got signed off for it today. He just did a dual cross country. It's his second dual cross country. So he's going to turn 17 in June and then get his private within the first couple weeks of after he turned 17. So he's kind of on the Bob Allen plan.
Yeah, don't let him go fly skydivers.
No. Well, we know better, man. My parents didn't know anything. I didn't tell them anything. I mean, you know, I was just trying to figure it out on my own.
Yeah.
And without the internet.
Exactly. You know? I didn't have anybody in my family that was in aviation. I mean, the farthest thing from aviation, they were in agriculture. I mean, they were in the cattle business.
Mine were psychologists and musicians.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we both had like polar opposite, you know, situations of aviation. And,
right.
You know, the only mentors I had were, you know, people at the airport that I hung out with that were drug smugglers and
yeah. This whole last few years of like the gangbusters, anybody who can fog a mirror gets hired at a major, upgrades real quick. I mean, I've never seen anything like it, and obviously it's not going to last. And a lot of the younger pilots that are kind of just barely missed that window. I understand the frustration, because a couple of years ago, you could go to fly an RJ for a year and then within a year be in the right seat of a 777, you know, at United or something.
Yeah.
And then a year after that in the left seat of a 73 at United. And look, when I was at Allegiant, you know, for 10 years towards the end of that, I was jump seating on American, I guess, US Airways, where there were FOs that were getting ready to retire and they just never upgraded because their number never came up. You
right.
know, so there's there's always someone that's had it worse in this business, and just stick around in it and you'll get to do all the things, And you want to do all the things.
Exactly. You should want to go do all the things. I mean, look, if you got into this whole industry, if you became a pilot because you saw the airline salaries and you thought that, you know, the only reason that you got into aviation was to get your pilot's license and then three years.
The girls. You get all the girls.
Yeah. Well, that's why you should get into it.
What aviation business are you in?
Yeah. Never mind.
Are you recruiting right now, Bob?
Right. Oh, man. Now you made me lose my train of thought. Girls.
That's the way this goes. We're just rambling. I mean, this is the rambling episode. Maybe it's what the episode's title will be. Just rambling. Yeah,
exactly. It's good. It's good, though, because I like talking about the career thing. I get questions about it constantly from younger pilots that are either frustrated or looking for advice. And, you know, that's what I always say. Hey, enjoy the ride. I mean, you'll get to where you want to be eventually. I promise. If you stick with it long enough, you're going to go be the airline pilot or the, you know, Gulfstream pilot, whatever you want. I mean, it's just like set your goals.
That may be what you think you want to be. My whole life I wanted to be an airline pilot until I was one for a while. And then
me too.
I didn't know there was anything else. And then I found something else and I liked it better.
Yeah. I got to the airlines and honestly, I hated it. I was bored out of my mind. I got into this for the adventures. I wanted to go on adventures and have fun. And the best thing that ever happened to me was like having a terrible airline career and getting it, not pursuing it long term. Look, you know, I was the guy that would interview at major airlines, get turned down, and I just kept plugging along. I just kept getting the jobs that I could get and enjoying what I was doing. And, you know, if I made it into, you know, one of those major airlines, so be it. You know, I'm honestly looking back now, I'm glad that I was never hired, because I would be completely miserable at 60 years old and being with the same airline, doing the same kind of flying for 30 years.
Yeah. I mean, some people, it suits some people and there's different strokes for different folks. I mean, like if you have a robust family life and social life and like it's a job and you can just kind of go do the job and realize there's going to be ups and downs and you collect a nice salary and your marriage is strong enough to deal with the not being there and missing important things like we talked about last week, you know, maybe you're cut out for it. And maybe you'll get there and you'll decide you want to get into management or you want to get into training or you want to shift to the corporate side or you want to go just start your own thing. I mean, look, we started our own thing. What we do didn't exist and we started our own thing and we got lucky, I think.
For sure. No doubt. It's all timing, luck, all kinds of variables. That just happened.
And we just, you know, we got good at it and here we are.
Yeah.
So, and now we're trying to be podcasters. So
yeah, exactly. And
life takes you to different places.
I don't know what's around the corner. I don't, you know, 5 years from now, who knows what I'll be doing.
I don't know. I'm excited about some of the stuff that we're talking about doing. And, I can't wait to, and the thing is we're going to get to share it with everybody once it starts happening. So this is just the beginning, guys. We're getting through every week here and putting stuff out, but this is just the beginning. We have much bigger plans for this whole thing. Not just talking heads. We want to get out there, out in the world with some cameras and Stay tuned. Bob, we did it. We managed to BS for an hour and I think it was okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, we could probably go on for another hour if I don't know if anybody would listen to us, but
yeah. Let's get a guest next week. Let's get maybe a DAR or maybe our ops. Maybe we can get our ops on next week.
Yeah, I would be cool to have some of our ops people, if not all of them.
Everyone wants to meet them. Everyone wants to meet like the people that really run the show. I mean, we're just
and they should. They got much better personalities than us.
Yeah.
I mean, they're more enjoyable to listen to.
We've been wanting to get Wes on. I mean, Wes is supposed to be the third host. I mean, we got to get Wes on here.
Yeah.
These days. He's got an interesting story, man. Bush pilot, started a Maldivian airline, and oh man,
yeah, seaplanes. I mean, yeah, he's the perfect guy to talk to about career stuff and
yeah, you
know, enjoying those cool jobs and talk about some really cool jobs.
I mean, he's a Canadian expat all over the world, man. I mean, he's barely lived in Canada as an adult,
so. Right.
So, all right. Well, look, let's wrap it up here and we'll have some good stuff for you next week. Hope you enjoyed the pod and fly safe out there and don't do anything that we wouldn't do.
See y'all.